It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client,
Mama Monster,
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Ah, leaves are falling. The temperature is finally cooling off. It's my favorite month of the year. Well, we're not there yet, but tomorrow is October 1st. That means today is Sunday, September 30th, 2018. I am the Sala Monster. Welcome to episode 566 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off. October is, and not just because it's my birthday, but October is always my favorite month. I feel like September into early October, you get the best weather. It's not too hot. It's not too cold. Of course, Halloween is coming up. That never hurts. So I'm in a pretty good mood. I was not in a good mood when a lot of you told me that Google decided not to push the podcast out last week. I got a lot of emails, a lot of tweets from people, Facebook posts. And so I looked into it. And sure enough, I log into my Google podcast portal. And I see all of the recent episodes. And they're all published. And then that one episode, 565 from last week, still says processing. Almost a week after it pushed out to everybody else. And I finally, it took about 4 days to get a response. Actually, 5 days, I think, from Google. They finally got back to me on Friday. They told me that we recrawled the audio, whatever the hell that means. And I noticed that it finally pushed out yesterday. So you should all be able to see it now. So all of you Google people, you get two shows in one weekend. But please, I would ask you this. Please do yourselves a favor. I don't know what Google's problem is, but if this happens again, or if, let's say, you know, there's another week and you're wondering, huh, there's no show, where's the show? You should know by now. It is rare that I do not do a show. In fact, before this year, I had not missed a show in 8 years. So if you see no show by Monday, I'm either dead, or you figure that Google is once again screwing the pooch over here, and you can grab the show from somewhere else. Might I suggest one new place that you could listen to the podcast as of this week, I'm happy to announce, is iHeartRadio. The Sound Off is now available for streaming on both the iHeartRadio website and their mobile app for iOS and Android devices. It is just one more platform, one more way for you to listen to this show. Above and beyond iTunes and Spotify and Stitcher and a ton of other places. So don't let Google screw you over. There's always a way to get this show. I mentioned Halloween before, and I'm happy also to announce it's been a while since we've had a new shirt up in our store on Pro Wrestling Tees. There is a brand new Sound Off shirt in the spirit of Halloween that is up in our store. It comes in two colors. You can get it on in charcoal, which is my personal favorite, or blood red, just in time for Halloween. I think it's a pretty cool design. I want to thank Steve for his help putting that together. So you can order the shirt now. And get it in time for Halloween, right? So if you're going to get the shirt with the expectation that you'll have it in time for the end of October, I would go ahead and order that now and not wait too long on that. ProWrestlingTees.com/SalaMonsterSoundsOff is the address. We have a new Halloween movie coming out October 19th that I'm very excited about. Jamie Lee Curtis back. John Carpenter back. And we may be doing a Halloween meetup the night before the Evolution pay-per-view. That's Saturday at the end of the month. That's not confirmed yet, but I'll probably make a decision one way or the other on that in the next week or so. So anyway, go to the store and order the shirt now if you want to get it in time for Halloween. Of course, keep using our Audible link as well, audibletrial.com/SalaMonster. Sign up for the free trial and get yourself one free audiobook that you get to keep no matter what. It's my Halloween gift to you. Thank you to everybody who donated this week and made a contribution to the show via PayPal. You can do so on thesalamonster.com. Right-hand side of the page is where that box is parked, or I guess the button it would be. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout-out here on the show. I want to say thank you to Chuck Lunatic Lentz, and also thank Chuck for the iTunes review. He couldn't believe he hadn't left one. He's been listening to this show probably for as long as I've been doing it. So thank you to him for that. John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Downtown Kenny Brown, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, Stephen Handyman Halistick, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard. From the Chicago Slayer, we have the Chicago Screamer, Ian Noel Camelotes, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T. We have also Radiant Ray Wrighton. Yesterday was RJ's birthday, and she is celebrating the entire weekend. The hell with that, I say just take the entire week off and celebrate. I'm a big believer that if it's your birthday, you should take at least a week off, maybe even the entire month. And you should be paid for it. That's my take on it. I don't run a business, though, like your employer does, so I can't make those decisions. But from one Libra to another, I wish you a happy birthday. No Way Out, Nick Fugit, who gave me a nickname. I saw in the email he sent me, he called me the Glass Leg. I don't appreciate that. Brings back bad memories. The Renton Road Warrior, Taylor Schatt, Glory Hound, Keith Doherty, the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, Mario the Menace, Rios, the Icon, Angelo Carter. Thank you for the first-time donation. And Igor Asimov Ed is having his first birthday on Wednesday. The Bundle of Destruction. You have the Brothers of Destruction? Well, here we have the Bundle of Destruction. He looks all cute, but when you mess with him, bad things happen. But he's celebrating his first birthday on Wednesday, so happy birthday to him. And congrats again to Simon and the family. Also, shout out to Len Streets and Eats Smalls. His team has a YouTube channel called Michigan Streets and Eats, where he and a few of his friends go to different restaurants, bars, other stores and places throughout the state of Michigan to promote all of the exciting things that you can do there and the positive growth overall that is happening there. Just type in Michigan Streets and Eats in the search box on YouTube. It will be the very first thing that comes up. He's got a few pretty cool videos up there, so go ahead and check that out. Also want to show some love for Ryan Bailey, Chris in Michigan, Ken C., Kevin, Millennium B., Aheadblom7, DJ Eon95, and Big Bad Booty Daddy 5150 for the love that they showed this podcast in iTunes as well. So I want to say thank you very much for that. One final plug here before we move on. One last little piece of business here for one of our listeners. And this is actually kind of a unique shout out. I don't know that in all the years I've been doing this that I've shouted out something like this before. But this is a shout out for him for the Illinois Minimum Continuing Legal Education Board, or MCLE Board for short. It's a fairly obscure government agency, and he would like to see more of a social media following for it, particularly if you're in the Illinois region, because it does run a legal education program for Illinois licensed attorneys. So you can follow them on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. They're on all three, at MCLE Board. So if that is in your wheelhouse there, if you live in Illinois, near Illinois, go ahead and check that out. There's a busy week coming up. I will be at the New York Comic Con at the Javits Center for sure Thursday. I don't know for how long, but I'll be there Thursday, maybe part of Friday. So if you're sort of milling around and you see me or we bump into each other, do say hello. This is my first Comic Con. I'm looking forward to it. Should be fun. Also, Friday night, got to also plug this here because this is a big show, big House of Glory show coming up Friday night. Extreme Warfare in Queens at their New York City arena. Sami Callihan takes on Bully Ray, and Anthony Gangone defends his newly won House of Glory championship against PCO, Pierre-Carl Ouellette, the ageless wonder, 50 years old, and this guy is having a career resurgence. It is crazy to think that this guy was only 27 years old when he played that pirate character, and he stole Bret Hart's jacket. I know he wants a match with The Undertaker at WrestleMania. I want, you know, a chicken that shits gold nuggets, but I'm not getting that either, so at least he and I have something in common. But anyway, PCO is challenging for the championship at House of Glory. That's a big match. So anyway, check them out. It is a professionally run operation, one of the biggest indies that you can find out on the East Coast, probably anywhere in the country, really. They bring in big names. They have a lot of homegrown talent there. Obviously, I had the pleasure of being part of the last show, and hopefully we'll do so Friday as well. So that's coming up on Friday night. Then, of course, on Saturday, it is Super Showdown. This is WWE's birthday gift to me, WWE's five-hour birthday gift. It is listed on the WWE Network schedule as a five-hour show. There's no mention of a kickoff. There's no mention of a pre-show. The actual show will be 5 hours long. It's like the Australian WrestleMania. 5 a.m. Eastern start time for this show. And because I don't do a podcast, I will not be doing a podcast before Super Showdown because it's on Saturday. I figure, well, now would be as good a time as any to just knock out these predictions a week in advance. So these are, you know, I'm doing these predictions based off all of the promotion, all of the hype, up to the Sunday before. That is when I am recording this. We still have the go-home shows this week. I suppose a lot can change. I don't know that a whole lot is going to change. It's going to change my mind on these. So let's run through the card here and spit out some Super Showdown predictions. Cedric Alexander is going to defend his Cruiserweight Championship against Melbourne's own Buddy Murphy. This show is taking place from the Melbourne Cricket Ground. And so Buddy Murphy will be the hometown boy. And between that and the fact that I think Cedric has had this championship now for, God, I mean, how many months has he been champion for? Probably going back to, what, WrestleMania? So he's been champion for a long time. And, you know, what I've seen of Buddy Murphy, the guy is incredible. You know, when I do check out stuff from 205 Live, you know, he and Mustafa Ali are the two names that really jump out at me. And that's not to take anything away from Cedric. I'm still a big Cedric Alexander fan, and I think he could do well for himself even on the main roster if he ever escapes the division. I mean, right now he's sort of the king of that division, so it's a good place for him to be in. But at some point, I would like to see him mixing it up with, you know, actual main roster talent. That being said, I think he's had a nice run, but I think now is the time to pull the trigger on a title change, and what better place for it to happen than in Melbourne. So I'm going to go with Buddy Murphy. I think he becomes a new Cruiserweight champion. We have Asuka and Naomi against the Iconics. Speaking of hometown folks, obviously, they also are returning to their homeland, are the Iconics. Now, I thought about this. I said, what are the chances that WWE is going to put two different home, I call them hometown acts, but two different hometown or homeland acts over on the same show? So many times we've seen people go to their home city, their home country, they lose. How many times have we seen that happen? I'm going out on a limb here by predicting the Iconics, because that's expecting them to put all of the Australians over on the same show. But I'm going to go with the Iconics. The Iconics, and not just because they're in Australia, but because they need this win. The Iconics have been a massive disappointment, at least to me. They've been a massive disappointment on the main roster so far. They've done really nothing of any great note. They've sort of had the same fate befall them that you know, befell Sanity, in that Sanity had some success in NXT. You know, they were part of that big War Games match last year. There was a period where Sanity, believe it or not, was a hot act until they hit the main roster. And then it all came to an end. It all came crashing down. The Iconics, you know, they have their act that they do, where they sort of mock everybody and they're very annoying. But when you look at their body of work in terms of their feuds or their matches, they've done nothing. They've done absolutely nothing of note on the main roster. Now, I don't want them to, you know, pin Asuka or anything like that. I think they could probably, you know, they can get the fallen Naomi. But to give them a win, I think, on the show is at least some attempt to give them some credibility here. I think they need it a lot more than Asuka and Naomi do, so I'm picking the Iconics. We have the New Day defending the SmackDown Tag Team titles against The Bar, Sheamus and Cesaro. This could be the sleeper match on the show. Probably won't be, just because there's a lot of other big matches on this show. I'm sure they'll deliver. But this should be really good. I don't really see any reason to switch the titles off New Day just yet. If The Bar wins, great. You know, I've become more of a fan of theirs, especially when Cesaro I've always been a fan of. But you can't go wrong with either one of these teams. I'm sure it'll be an excellent match. I'm picking New Day to retain. We have Daniel Bryan and The Miz one-on-one. The winner will earn a WWE Championship opportunity. They don't say when, only that at some point they will get a crack at the WWE title. And I've been saying this for a while, and in light of what they've done on TV, I really have not changed my mind. I'm going to stick to what I had said probably about a month ago, which is that Miz wins. I think Miz wins again. This would be his second straight singles win over Daniel Bryan, coming off the win at SummerSlam. And I think that Miz goes on to get a crack at the championship. They kind of split them up a little bit for a while. I think you put some distance between Miz and Bryan for a few months, and you come back to it, maybe for WrestleMania, with Bryan challenging Miz for the championship, and that is where and when Bryan wins back the WWE title. That's one way I would go about doing things. I don't know what happens then to AJ Styles going into WrestleMania. We could always, you know, talk about that as we get closer. But I think that's how I see this shaking out. Now, how does it happen? Well, and I floated this idea on the show last week. I think that Randy Orton is looking for a new victim. And it ain't Ty Dillinger, despite what they did on Thursday, on Tuesday. It ain't Ty Dillinger. Who is his next victim? Who is the next babyface? Who's the next fan favorite that he's going to go after? I think it's going to be Daniel Bryan. Could be AJ, but I think it's going to be Daniel Bryan. And I think he's not scheduled Orton for a match on this show. I think he'll be there. I think he will interfere. I think he will do something to cause Bryan the match. And because of that interference, Miz will win. And that then sets off Bryan and Orton on a program together. And Miz can challenge Styles, I presume Styles, at some point for the championship. We have John Cena, who has taken up residence in China. I assume he's filming some kind of movie there. But he is living in China right now. Actually, I'll tell you what, he's been posting these videos, or they've been putting up videos of him on WWE's YouTube channel, of him just sort of walking around the streets of China, this particular province that he lives in. He's going through the markets. He's showing how certain foods are made. And it's so weird because Cena's growing his hair out. You know, he kind of looks like a guy who, yeah, obviously he split away from Nikki Bella. And he's sort of, I don't know, changing things up a little bit. He moved as far away from her as possible. And I've liked those videos they've been putting up. I've been very entertained and they're informative. And so if you haven't seen any of them, I would go on their YouTube channel and check them out. But he is leaving China. He's leaving the confines of China to come to Australia. He'll be teaming with Bobby Lashley. They're going to be taking on Kevin Owens and Elias. This just seems like a slam dunk easy win for Cena and Lashley. Hopefully Leo Rush is there. Maybe he'll get involved in some way. But I'm picking Cena and Lashley. We have Becky Lynch defending her SmackDown Women's Championship against Charlotte Flair. Should be good. I'm digging what they're doing with Becky. Not so much with Charlotte, but I don't see them changing the title away from Becky just yet. So I think Becky retains. We have Ronda Rousey, the Raw Women's Champion, teaming up with the Bella Twins, Nikki and Brie, to take on the Riot Squad, although this match now, I guess, is in doubt, given what happened to Liv Morgan on Monday night, which I'm going to talk about here in a few minutes. I got some things to say about that. As of right now, the match is still on. I guess if Liv can't go because of her concussion, it could turn into a handicap match. My suggestion would be to get Brie Bella the hell out of there, and it could just be Ronda and Nikki, since that's probably the direction they're going in for Evolution anyway. And have just Brie, you know, be on the outside and, you know, drink and chant Brie mode or whatever she does. And it could be Ronda and Nikki, you know, against Ruby Riott and Sarah Logan if Liv can't go. But either way, I think Rousey and the Bellas get the win. Will the Bellas turn on her? Will there be some kind of miscommunication that causes them to lose? And that then leads to some, you know, bad blood between Nikki and Ronda? It could, but I don't see them eating the loss here, so I'm going to pick them to win. We have AJ Styles defending the WWE Championship against Samoa Joe. I believe this is no DQ, no countout. I should have written that down, but there is supposed to be a winner no matter what, so it is no DQ, no countout. There must be a winner here in this match. As much as I love what Samoa Joe has been doing, his mic work overall, this menacing personality that he has had on television, he has gone off the deep end, and I just love what they're doing with him. And I believe that he absolutely could have a nice run as the WWE champion, and there's no reason not to put the championship on him, whether it's now, whether it's later. And I know a lot of people think that Joe is walking out of Australia with the title. I just can't bring myself to believe that they're going to change the title here. I just feel like if it was going to happen, it would have happened by now. So I actually am going to stick with AJ. I think AJ Styles is going to retain the championship. They may still have another match. Maybe they'll have a match on SmackDown 1000. Who knows? Maybe they'll do the title change there. But I don't know. I just feel like AJ is going to pull it out. I feel like he's going to retain. They're not going to put the title, at least not yet, on Joe. Could be wrong. This one's a hard one to predict, but I'm going to stick with AJ. We have The Shield taking on, I guess they're calling them The Pack. Is that their name now for these guys? The Pack? I saw there was one website that had a house show listing for a live event that's coming, and it's The Shield against The Pack. So I guess that's their name now. I don't know if they're a super pack or what they're supposed to be. A pack of dogs, I guess. Braun Strowman, Dolph Ziggler, and Drew McIntyre. I think that what makes sense here is to give Braun Strowman, who did not win the championship at Hell in a Cell, who has yet to win the championship at all from anyone, I think you give him a little bit of a boost going into the triple threat at Crown Jewel with him and Roman and Brock Lesnar by having him not just win for his team, but I think that Braun Strowman should pin Roman Reigns to win this match. I think he should hit the running power slam, and I think he should pin him 1-2-3, fair and square, clean as a sheet, right in the middle of the ring. It's a six-man tag. He loses nothing by being pinned. We've seen this before. I was just watching, I was watching an old WWF pay-per-view. Oh, it was the In Your House International Incident from July of 1996. This was the month before Vader challenged Shawn Michaels for the championship at SummerSlam. And they did a six-man tag. Remember, it was supposed to be the Ultimate Warrior teaming up with Ahmed Johnson and Shawn Michaels, and then the Warrior flaked out and got fired. And so they brought Sid back, and it was Shawn Michaels, and it was Sid, and it was Ahmed Johnson against Vader and Owen and the British Bulldog. I believe that was the match. And Vader pinned Shawn Michaels to win that match. Now, why did he pin Shawn Michaels? Because A, he was the monster. He was still relatively new to the company. He was the monster. They wanted to have the monster pin the champion so that going into SummerSlam, he's got credibility and people think, well, he beat him once, he could beat him again. Same concept. This is no different. I don't care if it's 1996 or 2018. It's all the same. Some things never change. This is a very basic formula here. Braun Strowman should pin Roman Reigns. And that way he can point to having pinned him in the middle of the ring, going into Crown Jewel, and make you think he could do the same thing in Saudi Arabia, even though he won't. So I'm picking Strowman, Ziggler, and McIntyre, with Strowman pinning Roman to win the match. And then we have The Undertaker versus Triple H. Last time ever, but not really. One-on-one, Shawn Michaels will be in Triple H's corner. Kane will take a break from his mayoral duties. He will travel from Knox County all the way to Australia to be in his brother's corner for this match. You know, I will say this. They've done a good job of building this up and making it feel like a big match. A match going in that just felt like it was put together for no reason at all. All of a sudden, in light of this news that sounds like Shawn Michaels is going to come out of retirement and they're going to do a tag team match probably in Saudi Arabia, you know, on November 2nd, all of a sudden this match takes on a whole new meaning, and it seems like a means to an end. It seems like this match is a means to get to what would be that tag team match, and so you have to think that there's either going to be a no decision because of interference, or, I think, my prediction, is that Triple H wins. You know, they did a poll on WWE.com a couple of weeks ago. Who do you think is going to win at Super Showdown in Australia, Undertaker or Triple H? And it was some lopsided result. It was like 86-14, I think, in favor of The Undertaker. So they're not stupid. Well, most of the time. They realize that most people know going into this match, well, there's no way Triple H is going to beat The Undertaker. Of course The Undertaker is going to win. Well, now that we know it's not ending in Australia, that, again, they're trying to get to a point where they can do a tag team match, why not have Triple H beat The Undertaker? Even if it is a screw job, I don't expect them to hit a pedigree and pin him just like that. I'm sure Shawn Michaels will be involved. Maybe there'll be a super kick involved. Didn't work at WrestleMania 28. Don't mean that it won't work here at this show if he kicks Undertaker in the face. But I'm picking Triple H to win. And that then leads into whatever it is that they're going to do at the Saudi Arabia show the following month. But again, I will give them credit. The way they've built this up, the Undertaker's promos, I think have actually been better than what we've gotten from Triple H. And, you know, throwing Shawn Michaels in there, throwing Kane in there, it does add intrigue to the match. It does make me feel like, you know, are we transported back to 1998 here? But, you know, look, it's sort of the special attraction match on the show. It's no different than what you would see at WrestleMania. We get that every year. There's always at least one special attraction match, right? Usually the Undertaker's match. And so they want this to feel special. They're going to be in a stadium, 60, 70,000 people there. They want to go all out to make it special. This is one way to do that. Now, I don't know if it's going to headline the show or not. I think a lot of that will probably depend on what the finish is. Maybe they want to end on a happy note. Maybe they end with, you know, they don't have a universal title match. So I don't know that even without a universal title match, I still don't see them ending with a WWE championship match. I still feel like that WWE title is going to just be relegated to the second or third match, you know, from the bottom. But this is the real main event of the show. Don't let anybody tell you any differently. It's been promoted as the main event. It's been built up as the main event. They're putting all their star power in this match. And I do think Triple H is going to finally get one over on The Undertaker. And so that is your lineup for Super Showdown. Get stocked up on snacks. Wake up early. It's going to be a long show. When it is over, I'm not going to be watching it live. I'll probably tune in 2 or 3 hours later. 5 hour show. Man, such a long show. This is not how I wanted to spend my birthday. But when the show is over, I will record a review. I will get a review up on the YouTube channel. Probably will also include it on the podcast next weekend, to be honest with you, because I'm not planning on doing a normal podcast where I review all the different shows. I got to give myself a little bit of a break here. So you'll have your Super Showdown review on Saturday. It'll be up first on YouTube and then probably part of episode 567 next weekend as well. So that's the deal there. Let's move on here because we have other news to get to. Unfortunately, some of it's sad. Ted Turner, one of the key founding fathers of the Monday Night War period in wrestling, the man who gave Eric Bischoff famously 2 hours on Monday nights to go head-to-head with Vince McMahon, has revealed that he has been diagnosed with Lewy body dementia. That was the same disease that afflicted the late Robin Williams, although I don't believe he learned about it until after the fact. He had been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. I don't know when he found out or when his family found out that he had the Lewy body dementia. It might have been post-mortem, but it is the disease, one of the diseases that he suffered from. His wife, actually, Robin Williams' wife, wrote this really powerful article after his death a couple of years ago called The Terrorist Inside My Husband's Brain. And I would encourage you all to look it up and read it. It is a devastating account of what he went through. It's a progressive brain disorder that causes a whole host of different symptoms, behavioral changes, mood changes, forgetfulness, which Turner said he has experienced so far. He sat down with Ted Koppel to do an interview that aired, I believe it aired this morning, actually, before I just sat down to start recording this show. It was recorded for the CBS Sunday Morning News. And he explained to Koppel that he's already been experiencing some of these symptoms, the memory loss. It can be very frustrating. So he's already going through it. But this is one of the quotes that he gave to Ted Koppel in this interview. He said, "It's a mild case of what people have as Alzheimer's. It's similar to that, but not nearly as bad. Alzheimer's is fatal. Thank goodness I don't have that." So he says this, but then at one point during the interview, he pauses and he says, you know, dementia, and he's trying to think. He goes, "I can't remember what my disease is." And I'm not sure that what he said there is entirely accurate either as far as, you know, this not causing mortality. I don't believe that's the case. I think it very well could, or it does. But yeah, it's just a sad thing. I mean, here's a guy who launched CNN as that first 24-hour cable news station. I mean, whatever people think of cable news and CNN today, at the time, it was a very big deal. There was no 24-hour cable news outlet. CNN was the first, and he created it. You know, and here's a guy with a net worth of over $2 billion. I was curious. I had to look it up because I knew that he had lost a lot. You know, his fortune wasn't quite what it once was, and I wasn't sure where his net worth stood, but his net worth apparently still, even to this day, is over $2 billion. Although, the AOL Time Warner merger, which a lot of WCW people like to point to as, well, that's the reason WCW failed, ignoring all the other shit that they did to basically kill themselves. But that AOL Time Warner merger cost Ted Turner almost $8 billion. And in the end, it cost him his entire company because he got shoved out of power. But it is his influence in wrestling that I wanted to focus on here, because not just because this is a wrestling podcast, but because, and I said this on Twitter, who knows where wrestling would be today if Ted Turner had not put wrestling on those local TBS stations back in the 1970s, if he had not put, you know, wrestling on the Superstation, or in 88, you know, when he decided to buy Jim Crockett Promotions, which was bleeding money at the time. And then came Nitro in 1995. He wanted to know, how can we compete with Vince McMahon? The famous meeting, Eric Bischoff has talked about it. They're all sitting in a boardroom. Ted Turner looks at Eric and says, how can we compete? How can we compete with Vince? And Bischoff figuring, well, I'll just shoot my shot here. I'm not going to get it, but all right, you want to know what we need? Give me 2 hours on Monday nights. If we can compete with them head-to-head on Monday nights, that's the best way to compete with Vince McMahon. And Ted Turner famously, shockingly, gave it to him. He turned to one of the Turner executives and said, give Eric 2 hours on Monday nights on TNT. And the rest is history. Now Bischoff may have been responsible for a lot of the creative decisions. The NWO, which was an idea that he lifted from something he had seen in Japan. And just overall, the overall direction of the company at that time, Bischoff does deserve a lot of credit for that. But it was always Ted Turner's money. It was the time on television that Turner gave to him, and it was the seemingly open checkbook that he had to sign away all of these big names from WWE, or people who had left WWE, people from Japan, the cruiserweights from Mexico. You know, there was a lot of variety on that Nitro show if you go back and watch it in 96, 97. But it was Ted Turner writing the checks that allowed Eric Bischoff to sign big names like Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage and Bret Hart, Scott Hall, Kevin Nash, among many, many others that helped turn the tide WCW's way and made it legitimately the number one wrestling promotion in the world for about 2 years or so. You know, and even when WCW was at its hottest, it was always sort of treated as the redheaded stepchild of the Turner Empire. Not by Ted, because, you know, everything I always read about him or quotes from him in interviews or that I've seen attributed to him over the years showed me that he liked wrestling. I don't know if Ted Turner grew up a wrestling fan or not. I don't think he did, but he liked wrestling. He respected it. He respected what it had done for him because it performed so well on his stations, you know, many years earlier. But the same can't be said for the other executives in that company at that time. They treated it like it was a redheaded stepchild, even when WCW was making money hand over fist. And many times there were people in that company who pitched the idea of, well, let's sell it. Let's get rid of it. We don't need it on our stations anymore. And every single time it was Ted Turner who rejected the idea and said, no, I want wrestling on my stations. You know, but that Monday Night War period also lit a fire under Vince McMahon's ass. It led to WWE eventually reclaiming the number one spot, while WCW pretty much just mismanaged itself into oblivion, which Turner was, you know, he was powerless to do anything about that. I doubt he even knew the extent to which the company was being mismanaged. And then the merger and other things were going on. I mean, the guy didn't just run a wrestling company. I mean, he didn't even run it, owned it, but, you know, he had CNN, he had the Atlanta Braves. Yeah, you know, this guy's a billionaire. He's got a lot of different investments. He's got a lot of different things to worry about. So what do? You delegate those responsibilities to people that you hope know what they're doing and have, you know, the best interest of the company in mind. And unfortunately, it got to a point in WCW where the inmates were running the asylum. And, I mean, you don't need me to go into all the different stories about what was going on. There's a lot of different reasons why WCW is no longer in business. It's not just Eric Bischoff's fault. It's not just the merger. It's not just the finger poke of doom. It's sort of this combination of all of these different things. And it's still amazing to me to think back. As hot as they were back then, it was a brief period. But as hot as that company was, and they were making tens of millions of dollars, and to go from that within a year or two, apparently to bleeding $60 million, like being in the red for tens of millions of dollars, is it's just so unbelievably stupid to me. And it makes me angry. It really does make me angry because you think about how wrestling is today. There's a lot of good. There's a lot of bad. Where might things be had there been somebody competent in power running that company at that time? Or had they brought in somebody who could sort of stop the bleeding and they could, you know, perform well enough to where they remained on Turner stations, or maybe they scored, you know, a TV deal with someone else. You know, WWF jumped over to TNN. Maybe WCW could have jumped over to USA. We'll never know. We'll never know. But it was a terrible thing for the wrestling business when WCW went under. As horrible as they were at the end, it was absolutely worse for the wrestling business overall. But I'm getting into the weeds on this a little bit. Ted Turner, though, was the man behind it. He was the one, because he can't do all the things they did without money. And without his support and without his money, you know, there is no WCW. It's just that simple. And you can extend that out even more. You know, there very likely is no $7 billion WWE juggernaut. There's no WWE network. There may be no WWE. I mean, I know it sounds over the top, but there's a very real possibility that WWE, without making the changes they made in the late 90s, out of, you know, this desperate need to compete because they had no choice, financially, doesn't survive. You know, they almost declared bankruptcy in 97. If I remember, it was actually one of the things that helped sort of reverse that trend was when they went to all three-hour pay-per-views. Basically copy WCW, which was already doing that. You know, WWE had the in-your-house shows that were 2 hours long. They made a change in the fall of 97 to go to 3 hours for every show, and they upped the price of their pay-per-views. I think they upped it by like $5 a month. All of a sudden, they started making money. All of a sudden, Vince McMahon went to Bret Hart and said, "Hey, you know that conversation we had where I said I couldn't afford to pay you anymore and I told you to go negotiate with Turner? Yeah, you know, about that, I think I can pay you now." And Brett said, "Well, it's too late. I already signed a deal with them. It's too late." But they were copying moves that WCW had already made. But if things go really sour for them in 97, I don't know that they make it to 1998. So for all the credit that Eric Bischoff deserves for his ideas and his contributions to WCW's success, I don't think you can talk about that success without first talking about Ted Turner. Let's talk about Raw from last Monday. Last Monday, they were in Denver, Colorado. I put up my usual Twitter poll. I had over 3,500 responses. 16% of you voted thumbs up. 23% of you voted thumbs down. And I think a record, 61% of you said you did not watch the show. And I get criticism from people, not a lot of people, but there have been people on Twitter, and I'm not saying that they're malicious or they're trolling or anything, but they write me and they go, "Well, clearly we know that the didn't watch option, you know, is just a combination of people who were just trolling, or they just hate WWE and they're just voting for the sake of voting. Of course, they're watching the show." And I've gotten this response from some people over the last few weeks since I added that third option. And I got it from people this week, of all weeks, because they saw the number was so high and they said, "Well, it's obvious what's going on here." I want you to remember this number. 1.64. That was the overall Raw rating for last Monday's show. 1.64. That equates to 2.3 million viewers. That is the second lowest rated Monday Night Raw ever to air on the USA Network. You would have to go all the way back to the December 23rd, 1996 edition of Raw, the pre-Christmas show, the holiday show, which did a 1.5 rating, for a number lower than the one they earned last Monday. I don't ever want to hear from another person questioning those poll numbers I put up saying, "Oh, the didn't watch number is clearly just a troll vote or a protest vote. It's not accurate." On the week that they did their second lowest number of all time, I get responses like that. Wake up, people. Wake up. This is real. This is a real phenomenon. I hear from people every single week who say they can't watch the show anymore. I can't do it. I don't know how you do it, Solid Monster. I can't do it. You're a better man than I am. Or, I haven't watched a full episode of Raw or SmackDown in 6 months, or 3 months, or 9 months. This is not an isolated tweet or an isolated email. Every single week, I get emails from people. Some people who I know have been listening to the show for a long time. Some people I know personally. And I believe them. Now, some people will make this argument. They'll say, well, it's the fall season. This happens every year. The NFL is back. Oh, really? Oh, really, Einstein? Is that the case? Well, that's funny to me, because I could have sworn last time I checked that fall comes every year. Just as sure as WrestleMania and Santa Claus and the friggin' Easter Bunny come every single year. And yet, every year that goes by, we seem to be setting new record lows. Every year, lower and lower. How low can we go? Raw has never been as dangerously close as they are now to dipping below 2 million viewers. And it may not happen this week. They may rebound this week and get a 500,000 viewer boost. It may not happen this week. It may not happen next week or the week after that. But I hope it does. I hope it does. Because the show is largely, not completely, there are bright spots on the show, and I'm going to talk about them in a second. You know, if you have 16 different segments on this show, not all 16 are trash. So, the show is largely, not completely, terrible. Week after week after week. And the last thing we need is for the numbers to go up. And for them to think that what they're doing is actually entertaining. It's not. Now, the problem is, and I talked about it when we discussed the new TV deals a few months ago. What happens then? Let's say that happens. Let's say the numbers do drop. What then? And the sad reality is, probably nothing. Nothing will happen. We may get a Vince McMahon sighting on TV. When things get bad, they run to the bat signal and they slap Vince's face on it and they shine it over the sky over his house. Or we'll get more big names making appearances on TV. Let's drag out The Undertaker's ass. Let's drag out Shawn Michaels. Let's put Mick Foley on the show. Try to pop a big number. Band-aid on a gunshot wound. I'll say it every single time. I don't mind seeing those guys every now and then. It's good to see the old names. But to rely on them and to drag them out as your secret weapon? We're long past that point. Band-aid on a gunshot wound. That's all it is. But why do I think nothing is going to happen? WWE stock closed on Friday, almost $97 a share. They may hit $100 a share this week. Have a market cap over $7 billion. What do you think is going to happen? Now, on the show this week, they did a show-long storyline around Dean Ambrose and Dolph Ziggler and Drew Galloway trying to, you know, convince him that these are not your friends, they don't care about you, they didn't call you in those 9 months when you were out recovering from your injury, they have championships, you don't. They were saying and doing all of these different things to try to stir the pot and convince Dean Ambrose that he should turn on his Shield brothers. In fact, they went a little too over the top with it to the point where I figure now it's not happening. Because otherwise, boy have they telegraphed it. And I tend to think these things work a lot better when you don't telegraph it. That's why it was so shocking, I think, to see Seth Rollins when he turned on Roman Reigns and Dean Ambrose back in 2014. Not too many people saw that coming. As evidenced by that one guy in the crowd just before Seth hit Roman in the back of the chair. If you go back and watch it, I'll never forget it. You could hear a guy in one of the front rows literally scream no, like he was about to see somebody get shot. He did not want to see that happen. Now they're on television, they're telegraphing it, they're telling you that, oh, Dean Ambrose is going to go heel, he's going to turn on the Shield, and WWE 101 would dictate that instead it'll end up being Rollins again or something just to swerve us. I certainly hope that doesn't happen. But anyway, that was the storyline that they were pushing the entire show. There were different segments where Ziggler confronted Ambrose in the back and said, I'm just here to just say something to you. And again, he's making his case. He's making his pitch. Oh, we're here for you. Those guys aren't. And so they wanted to plant the seeds of doubt about what would happen going into the main event, which was going to be the Shield against Baron Corbin and two mystery men. And I'll talk about that in a second. So at least they had a story that they were building the show around. I tend to think the shows do benefit from having some kind of show-long theme or storyline instead of things just being thrown together. So that's good, at least, even if I'm not completely sold on the story. The thing about it, though, is that it is believable, right? It is. We've been talking about this. A lot of people, not just me on this show, have been talking about the fact that if they wanted to turn Dean Ambrose heel, they've never had a better time to do it than now, because all of the things that Dolph Ziggler was saying on television Monday night are true. That's what you and I have been saying. All the focus is on Roman. Roman is this champion, and Seth has the Intercontinental title, and Ambrose has nothing, and he should feel left out, and he should feel frustrated. All of these things that Dolph Ziggler was articulating on television on Monday night, even though I wish it was sort of left unsaid. Anyway, that was the key story built around the show on Monday night. So let's get to what everybody was talking about all week, which is Brie Bella. Brie Bella was the talk of the town coming out of the show on Monday night. It was the Bella Twins and Natalya against the Riot Squad. And we had Brie Bella in the ring with Liv Morgan. Liv Morgan is down on her knees. Brie Bella is hitting her with the S-kicks from her husband, Daniel Bryan. And she's kicking and she's kicking and she's kicking and she's looking over at the other corner and she's pointing at them and, oh, this is for you. And she accidentally kicks Liv Morgan flush right in the face. Just kicked her right in the face. Liv is obviously momentarily stunned, momentarily knocked out, falls forward a little bit, gets hit by another kick. Flush, right in the face. That's two kicks to the face. And then she collapses down on the mat. Brie goes for the pin, Liv with a very weak kick out. It's obvious to anybody watching that she's not quite right. And at this point, the referee should, because every time, I feel like every time somebody does a dive, every time there's some kind of big slam, the referee, almost to the point of annoyance, but you just sort of accept it, because what are you going to do? You're going to say that they shouldn't keep the talent safe? I just feel like now, they sometimes even go a little overboard with it. You know, back in the day, you'd watch matches, you wouldn't have the referee, after every single bump, slide down and try to talk to the wrestler to see if they're okay. Now they do it after almost every move. For whatever reason, that didn't really happen here. Or whatever the referee was thinking or saying, he left well enough alone for Brie Bella to grab Liv Morgan and pick her up by her neck and drag her back to her own corner so that she could tag out. Liv had no strength. She had no strength in her legs. She couldn't even stand. She kept falling. That was pretty stupid. Why the referee didn't step in there and stop that, I don't know. That's on him. So there's some blame to go around here on this. I will not put any on Liv Morgan. I see people, oh, it wasn't Brie's fault what happened. It was Liv, or it was 50-50. No, it wasn't. No, it wasn't. So let's not blame the victim in this. She never should have been allowed back into the ring after she tagged out. Liv Morgan did come back in. There was a triple suplex spot that she was a part of. She got suplexed. And then finally rolled out of the ring. And finally, I guess the doctor came over and they were tending to her and they realized that this girl may be concussed. As it turned out, she was. She suffered a concussion. I don't know how severe. They didn't put a grade on it. We don't have a whole lot of information other than she did suffer a concussion. WWE did confirm that. And there's no word on when she may be cleared to come back. It could be in a couple of days. It could be a few weeks. It could be a month. Dolph Ziggler went through a whole period once before where he was out for an extended period of time before they finally cleared him and he wasn't suffering from, you know, headaches and symptoms anymore. So concussions are a very weird thing. I mean, it affects people in different ways and it depends on how bad it is. So we just don't know. Whether she'll be at Super Showdown next weekend, we don't know. Now, it may be a blessing in disguise, frankly, if she doesn't wrestle in that match in Australia, because that means she won't have to risk getting back into the ring with future UFC Women's Champion over here, Brie Bella. So maybe it's better off that she stays on the outside or doesn't fly all the way to Australia at all. But there's been a lot of wrestlers coming out, and not all of them, but the large majority of the ones I saw were basically pushing back against the fans and defending Brie and basically saying, well, shit happens. I think that actually might have even been Bully Ray's exact words. Shit happens. It's wrestling. It's not ballet. All the usual cliches that you hear. I'm not even saying that's wrong, but we got a lot of the same boring cliches we always hear. We had Tommy Dreamer on Busted Open Radio. He says, for anybody who said it's a botched spot or that Brie was at fault, they are 100% incorrect. No one ever goes in there with the intent to injure their opponent. It was nobody's fault. It was a missed timed thing. And I see other wrestlers making the same argument. Taz, I believe, was another one who said, well, she didn't mean to do it. She didn't do it on purpose. There wasn't any malice intended. No shit! Who is saying that there was malice involved? I never saw anybody say that. I didn't have people on my timeline saying, oh, she meant to do that. Like she's a headhunter. Like a pitcher going into a baseball game who knows I'm going to throw at this guy's head. That's not what she was doing. I didn't see one person make the argument that this was done on purpose. So why would you even spit that argument out? What does that even have to do with whose fault or who may or may not be at fault? We're not talking about intent. Intent is not what is being questioned here. One has nothing to do with the other. So that's a false argument that's being peddled by a lot of wrestlers who probably are just tired of having fans chime in because the fans don't know what they're talking about. It's the whole Goldust thing from what happened at the last pay-per-view that we just had. Hell in a Cell. When he chimed in, you know, people were talking about the Becky Lynch angle after she won the championship. And they were saying whatever. I mean, there was one person who said something in response to a Goldust tweet. It wasn't disrespectful at all. And Goldust's tweet was something to the effect of, you know, your opinion means shit. He didn't use those exact words, but that's basically what he was saying. And I've seen a lot of this lately. It's like this little mini war is brewing between wrestlers and fans, and I'm not sure where this is coming from, but it's noticeable. Brie Bella debuted 11 years ago in 2007. She has been in the ring off and on for 11 years. She's considered to be a veteran now. When they came back and they promoted the Bella's return a few weeks ago on Raw, remember all the commercials? Shawn Michaels was going to be on the show? Two legendary returns. Shawn Michaels and the Bella Twins. They're legends in this company. They are ring veterans. Now, maybe I'm just spoiled by all the really good female talent that we've been exposed to of late, right? I mean, I look at the Mae Young Classic as one example. I look at somebody like a Mercedes Martinez. Mercedes Martinez, she's a ring veteran, 18 years in the business. Io Shirai, maybe the best female wrestler on the planet right now. 11 years experience. She debuted the same year that Brie Bella did. Nicole Matthews, 12 years of experience. Mia Yim, 9 years of experience. Toni Storm, 9 years of experience. That's less than Brie, by the way. If any of them were in there and they did some of the things that Brie Bella has done, they would not be offered a contract. Or if they were, it would be a while before we saw any of them on television. They would be down there in Florida for months and months and months before we even see them on TV. This woman has been at this now for 11 years. This sort of thing should not be happening. And the whole thing with the dives. A couple of weeks ago, people keep saying, oh, she botched two dives. That's not true either. And I talked about that at the time. There was one dive that was not her fault. That was a Sarah Logan thing. That was a mistimed thing. So I wish people would stop saying she botched two dives because one of them was not her fault. The other one was. The other one was just, I don't know what the hell was going on there. And that was more a danger to herself than the other people that she was in the ring with or diving out onto. Yeah, but she has said, well, I had a child, and so when I dove, I have more weight on my body than I did back then, and so I didn't realize it, and I'm going to have to adjust. And that's a perfectly fine, if that's the case, unless she's making excuses here, if that's the case, then that's understandable. And that's not something any of the men on the roster can vouch for, because to my knowledge, none of the men on the roster have had a kid. So, fine, if that's the case, then you know what? Between that and what happened here, I mean, I don't know what the excuse was here. They have this wonderful place down in Winter Park It's called the Performance Center. They have 7 different rings down there for you to dive out of. And plenty of crash pads. Maybe it's time you go down there, you work off some of that ring rust. I heard that, oh, it's ring rust. Maybe go work off some of that ring rust before you get back into the ring. If you're posing a danger to yourself, or you're posing a danger to other people, maybe that's not such a bad idea. Just food for thought. But I watched that, and it's bad enough to kick somebody hard in the face once. How you do that twice? How after you connect with the first kick, and you feel your leg, your shin, slamming into this person's face, how that doesn't tell you, oh, maybe I should stop and not throw another kick, is something I'm still a week later almost trying to figure out. That's the thing I don't get. One kick is an accident. How you kick a person 2 times in the face like that, not realize what you did the first time, if that isn't her fault, if that isn't reckless, then I would love for you to tell me what is. So, you know, it's one of those things where accidents happen, and I'm sure she feels bad about what happened. You know, a lot of people, she rubbed the wrong way when she put a tweet up right after basically saying, you know, the accidents happen in the ring. And it's true. Accidents do happen. But this, what really just pissed me off were these wrestlers and people coming out, making the art. Well, there was no malice intended. It was like, where is that argument even coming from? Who are you rebutting with that argument? Because what the hell does that have to do with people being upset at Brie Bella that she kicked this woman not once, but twice in the face? And, you know, and I said, once is an accident, twice is being reckless. Oh, it's Liv Morgan's fault. She didn't take the move right. She was leaning forward. Yeah, she was leaning forward because she was fucking unconscious. I don't understand what's so hard to figure out about this. No, but the fans need to shut up. There was no malice involved. Give me a fucking break. Who is making that argument? It is a false argument. It is a bullshit argument. Nobody is saying that. So stop using it as an excuse. We had Connor of the Ascension beating Chad Gable clean in the middle of the ring with a Dominator. I figured, hey, they did swerve me on this. I thought it was going to be Connor against Bobby Roode. Instead, they kept Chad Gable in there. And I wonder if the reason that Bobby Roode is not wrestling any of these matches or winning the falls is because he is, in fact, going to turn on poor Chad Gable at some point. I have to think that's where this seems to be going. I guess we'll find out. But if I never see a member of the Ascension in the ring with a member of this team ever again, it'll be a day too soon. Got Drew McIntyre and Dolph Ziggler. They defended their Raw Tag Team titles against the Revival. This was one of the few bright spots on this show. This was a really good match. This was the best Revival match since they came to the main roster, and I hope they open some eyes backstage to the value that this team can have, because when I first saw the Revival in NXT, my thought when I looked at them was, these guys bore me just by looking at them. And they proved me wrong. They had great matches with American Alpha and other teams, and they were just lighting the world up on fire down there in NXT. They were one of the hot acts down there, having great match after great match. They can do the same on the main roster if they have the chance to do so. And I'm hoping that what happened on Monday night opened a lot of eyes backstage, and we get to see more of them, and we get to see more matches like this, because this, even though McIntyre and Ziggler won, this was really good. We had The Shield in the main event. They were facing Baron Corbin and 2 mystery men who turned out to be AOP. They were the mystery partners. This was AOP's first taste of the Raw main event. Strowman, Ziggler, and McIntyre came out. They were watching the match from the stage. They were sitting on some chairs. We had Dean Ambrose giving Baron Corbin dirty deeds. Took out, I believe it was Rezar with a suicide dive. And Roman Reigns hit Baron Corbin with a spear for the win. So the good thing is, AOP got exposure in the Raw main event. I thought they did fine. I thought they got some rub by being in there with the Shield. And they didn't eat the fall to lose the match. They let Baron Corbin take the fall. So I like that. I like that aspect of it. And in the end, Ambrose is sitting outside after having done that dive, and he's sort of sandwiched now in between the Shield in the ring, and then back up on stage you have, McIntyre and Ziggler and Strowman, and there's some debate about, okay, who's he going to side with? Where's he going to go? Well, he rolled into the ring, he made his choice, he went back to his Shield brothers, and everybody cheered, and that's how they went off the air. But you still now, after what they had Ziggler out there saying, they have planted those seeds in the ground, and they're being watered as we speak, to make you think that in the end, Dean Ambrose probably feels exactly the way that Dolph Ziggler said he feels. And maybe he won't go to side with Ziggler and them, but at some point, a turn may be coming. And it's just a matter of when. I just felt like they shouldn't have telegraphed it as much as they did on this show. I wish they didn't do that. I would like to still see at some point Ambrose turn on those guys and have a crazy heel run as a single star, and then he can feud individually with Rollins and then with Reigns and maybe challenge him for the championship, but we're not there yet. In fact, I don't see anything happening until at least Survivor Series, and actually, if you think back a few weeks, I think we were talking about that and maybe holding off until then. This was back when I thought that, you know, bringing Kevin Owens back, not after a week, but bringing him back with the Undisputed Era, setting up for Survivor Series match, having that as the place where Ambrose would turn. And, I mean, they could still have Ambrose turn if there's some kind of Survivor Series match. It just, you know, wouldn't be against Kevin Owens in the Undisputed Era, but they could still do that. SmackDown Live was in Denver again. They were back there the very next night. I want to just thank Wade Keller real quick for having me back on his weekly SmackDown Recap podcast. We were talking about SmackDown Live. You can go back and listen to that show if you'd like to. It's up on his site. Twitter poll, over 2,500 votes, 45% thumbs up, only 6% thumbs down, 49% did not watch. No great matches on the show this week, but as far as storytelling, they had two cliffhanger stories on the show. I was pretty entertained also by the Truth TV stuff. It was one of those things when I first saw it, I kind of just groaned. But it turned out to be a lot more entertaining than I expected it to be. I think, you know, Truth has really found himself since he came back from his injuries. He's really found himself a solid role as comic relief on this show. Kind of like what Santino used to be on Raw back in the day. But overall, as a show, I actually thought it was good this week. But you could tell how thin the roster is on that brand with, in terms of top baby faces, once you get past AJ, you know, maybe one other person, Daniel Bryan, it starts to get pretty thin up top, which is something Baron Corbin knows a little bit about, which is why he's bald now. But, you know, baby faces, tag teams, even the women's division on this show, I think they could really benefit from a few NXT call-ups. I don't know if those NXT call-ups would benefit from being called up, but I think the SmackDown roster could benefit from having a few new faces added. Truth and Carmella, in that opening segment, they basically took over Miz TV. They rechristened it as Truth TV. They interviewed Daniel Bryan. Miz eventually came out. When he tried to speak, Carmella yelled, "Dance break!" And then they did the 7-second dance break gimmick. Which is something I would consider doing on this show, in fact. Maybe I'll start taking some 7-second dance breaks here on the Sound Off. Play some music. And I will spare you the sight of watching me dance. Carmella, you know, watching her here, I think that she would be so much better as a valet, as a ring announcer. She did the ring announcing to get Daniel Bryan out to introduce him, and I thought she did a hell of a job. I think she's better at all of these different things, even more than she is in the ring. And it's one of these things where I don't necessarily think that every single female on the show, save for Stephanie, and she's wrestled before too, but I don't think every single female on this show also needs to wrestle. It's like, you know, if Miss Elizabeth came along now, they'd have her taking roles at the Performance Center to get her ready. Maybe Carmella's one of these people who would be better off doing other things. We had Becky Lynch attacking Charlotte. Charlotte was in the middle of a photo shoot backstage, which my first thought was, why are you doing a photo shoot with Charlotte? The champion is here. Why should she not be the one in the middle of that photo shoot? And Becky felt the same way. And she attacked Charlotte and she left her laying and she put her foot on top of her. And she said, take the champ's picture. I love Becky Lynch. Keep doing what you're doing. I love what they're doing with Becky Lynch right now. We have this Rusev, Lana, Aiden English drama. This is one of the cliffhangers I mentioned a few moments ago. We have, now that Aiden has turned on Rusev, and Rusev Day is no more, Aiden made a comment as they were going back and forth. He was cutting promos on each other in the arena. And Aiden made a comment to Lana about something that happened in Milwaukee. And Rusev had no idea what Aiden was talking about. Lana played it off like she had no idea. Although you could kind of tell that she knows what he's talking about and is just sort of pretending that she doesn't know. And they want you to think that it's some sort of torrid affair or a one-night stand between them. Of course, it won't end up being that way, I'm sure. But that's how they left it. See, my prediction was going to be that Lana lost her accent to Aiden in Milwaukee. Because I don't know where her accent has gone. It kind of comes and goes. I don't know where they're going to go with this. I'm just thinking, okay, where do I think they're going with this? I don't think it's going to be the obvious, oh, they had a one-night stand type of thing. It is a PG show, after all. But the last time we got a soap opera storyline like this involving Rusev and Lana was the one, if you remember, with Summer Rae, which they spent months and months on, and it went nowhere. So hopefully that's not the case here. Already Aiden English is promising video proof of this Milwaukee encounter, incident, whatever, on SmackDown this Tuesday. It's smart. It's very, very smart for them to have things and have stories like this because it keeps people wanting to see what comes next. I have no idea what they're going to reveal. I'm going to wait and find out just like all of you. I am intrigued. I am curious to see where they go with this. I will tune in on Tuesday in part to find out what happens next in this story. So I think that's a positive. I think that's a good thing. It's good for Aiden English, too, because it's not just a one and done, oh, he'll wrestle Rusev and get beaten and never be heard from again. I'm not worried so much about Rusev and what they do with him going forward. Aiden English, though, had a good thing going with this Rusev Day deal. And now that it's over, if I'm him, I'm very concerned. I'm very concerned about my future on this show. So the longer he's involved in something like this, the better it is for him. So we'll see where they go with it on Tuesday. I don't think it's going in the way that they want everybody to think. But I do think that something will be revealed. It's not just he's completely fabricating it. I think something did happen. What it is, though, I don't know. And maybe I just don't want to know. I want to wait and see what they come up with. We had Ty Dillinger challenging Shinsuke Nakamura for the United States Championship. He had the match won. I mean, it's Ty Dillinger, so probably not. But he thought he did. All of a sudden, Randy Orton ran out and attacked him for the disqualification. And he beat on him all around ringside, and he gave him a draping DDT from the apron to the floor. And then, poor Ty Dillinger, he's been DDT'd on the floor. He starts to rise. He's on his knees. He's kind of sitting up. And Nakamura comes out of nowhere and hits him with a Kinshasa, and Ty's head strikes the back of the LED apron. You can hear like a sickening thud as his head cracked against the LED board. And Randy Orton did this promo backstage with Mike Rome. Mike Rome interviewed him and wanted to know why he did what he did. And Randy said, well, this perfect 10 crap just pisses me off. That's his reason for attacking Ty Dillinger. I love it. I agree. And I would love it if just things that randomly irked Randy Orton is what caused him to just start attacking people. This guy looked at him the wrong way. You know, this guy poured his coffee wrong. He's wearing a t-shirt that doesn't belong to Randy Orton. Boom, RKO. Little things that set him up. Because remember, Orton has IED. Let us not forget the disease that this man has. IED, I think that's what it was called, right? IED, and he could go off at any moment. See, that's some storyline consistency there. I want them to bring that up. This man has been diagnosed with a condition he can fly off the handle at any moment. I didn't hear them mentioning that on Tuesday. But what's interesting is that, you know, there's now a pattern, as some people have pointed out, of Randy Orton. Now, it's a pattern of two, but it's a pattern of Orton attacking people that oppose Shinsuke Nakamura. First, it was Jeff Hardy. Now, it was Ty Dillinger. Is he gunning for a United States Championship match? Is that why he's doing this? Maybe Shinsuke's going to go babyface again, and they're going to feud, since it would make no sense to feud two heels for the championship. Maybe that's going to happen. I don't know. But there is some kind of weird connection there. It just seems like it's probably not a coincidence. And if it happens a third time, then we know for sure. Show was supposed to end with a contract signing for a Super Showdown with AJ Styles and Samoa Joe in the ring, and AJ was there. Samoa Joe was not. Samoa Joe popped up on the Titantron. And he was outside of AJ's home. In fact, AJ has a mailbox with the name Styles on it. Because all wrestlers, I like to think, on the outside of their home, on their mailbox, have their wrestling names on there. That's what I would like to think. I'd like to think that Rusev's mailbox says Rusev, or Rusev and Lana. You know, open the door, put the mail in, close the Rusev Crush, close the door. I would like to think that they all have their work names on their mailboxes. I would like to think that Papa Shango has a mailbox that just says Papa on it, you know, which could be taken so many different ways. So Joe is outside of AJ's home. He says, well, you're in Colorado. You're here. You're there. I'm here. Your family is home. And the whole time AJ is begging him, bro, like they're best friends. Bro, please, bro. Come on, bro. He morphed into Vince Russo all of a sudden. Come on, bro. Don't do it, Joe. Don't do it, man. I got a kick out of that more than anything else during this segment. Joe said, oh, I brought a gift for your daughter, Annie, and he had a doll in his hand. He had a present. And he said, you know what? I'm going to ring the doorbell. And he said, and he does. He rings the doorbell. He says, Daddy's home. And they immediately cut to black because they just completely ran out of time. And I liked that. I thought that was the best possible way they could go off the air. So no contract was signed. They could always do that this week. But you go off the air with a cliffhanger that keeps people wanting to watch and tune in the following week to see what the hell happened. This was sort of the PG version, I guess, of the Austin Pillman gun incident back in 96. Even in 96 when they did the Austin Pillman thing, they got in a shitload of trouble for that. USA did not like that. That was even then. That wasn't quite Attitude Era yet, but that was sort of the first signs of what would be the Attitude Era. But yeah, this was a much more sanitized version of just a wrestler going to another man's home, threatening to, attack his family. It's a creepy thing. If you have kids, if you have a family, I'm sure you can relate to that. And so I like this. And I also I like the fact that, you know, that screw job at Hell in a Cell, Joe got screwed out of the championship. We saw the video replay. He should be WWE champion right now, and he's not. He got screwed. And it just pushed him over the edge. And I was hoping that it would. And that's exactly what they've done here. They've gone down the road of Joe just losing his mind, becoming even more sinister and even more disturbed because of what happened. And I like that. I like psychotic, disturbing Samoa Joe. That makes, by the way, 2 6 disturbed individuals on this show. Samoa Joe and Randy Orton. So if I worked on the SmackDown roster, I'd be a little concerned for my safety right now. I don't know about that as a work environment, but I don't work on the SmackDown brand, so I don't need to worry about that. But I enjoyed this. So yes, the two stories coming out of the show, both cliffhangers, both keep you wanting to watch, unless you're just not watching the show, which apparently 49% of you are not. That's still better than the 61% of you who didn't watch Raw on Monday night. And there were people I saw who posted tweets saying, oh, why are so many people voting didn't watch? This was a good show this week. Well, because they're not watching. Because they've been turned off for so long by this product that even when you get a show that you consider to be good, they don't know it's good because they've already given up. The only solace is that it seems that fewer people have given up on SmackDown than they have on Raw. Now you need to consistently crank out these good shows and build good word of mouth to try to get some of those people back. Some of them you're never going to get back. But hopefully, if they put on a string of good shows, even better than what they gave us on Tuesday, which was good, but it could be better, hopefully you'll start to draw back in some of those people and those numbers will go down. Speaking of SmackDown, big announcement this week that Evolution is going to be reunited. Now, not the women's pay-per-view. We have two Evolutions now. Evolution will be at Evolution. No. Actually, it kind of makes me wonder. You know, they probably should have added a female to that faction at some point. They never did. That's the one thing that was missing from Evolution. They should have had a female in there somewhere. But they didn't. But the Evolution faction is reuniting on SmackDown 1000. This is the announcement from WWE.com. The band is back together. At SmackDown 1000 on Tuesday, October 16th, Evolution reunites. Triple H, Batista, Randy Orton, and Ric Flair will be in Washington, D.C. for the historic event. Evolution is comprised of some of the most successful superstars in history. There are 49 world championships between the four members who ran roughshod through WWE from 2002 to 2005, then rode again for a vicious rivalry with The Shield in 2014, what does Evolution have in store as they make their first ever appearance on the Blue Brand during this groundbreaking night? Yeah, you know, that is, and a lot of you have said, it's very odd that they would choose a SmackDown anniversary show to reunite what had been a Raw faction. They never once appeared on SmackDown back when they were together. They were always on Raw. Even though Batista absolutely belongs on this show, he was a big part of the Blue brand. He was Blue-tista for many years. He was a loyal SmackDown guy for a number of years before he got traded back to Raw. And, of course, he posted that tweet a number of weeks ago, very upset. You know, oh, they haven't called me to be part of the SmackDown 1000 show. And I said, look, it is kind of early. They could still contact him, and it seems like they did. I don't think he was posting that tweet, working everybody, knowing he had already been invited. In the last week or two, he probably got the call and said, hey, this is what we want to do, and we'd like for you to be a part of it. It is your hometown. And he agreed, and so now he's going to rightfully be on SmackDown. He won't have the spotlight fully on him because it's a group thing, but that's okay. Now, in the past, Batista's done many interviews. He has made it very clear he does not want to come back for a one-and-done. He doesn't want to come back part-time like a Brock Lesnar or an Undertaker. If he comes back, he would want one last full-time run, house shows and all. I get the impression he has a lot of fun doing the house shows. He would want the full experience one last time, however long that run goes for, and then he would retire and he would call it quits. He's also, now I don't know if that's changed or not. I know he wants to come back also to work a WrestleMania match with Triple H. He's made that very clear. There is another three-man group on SmackDown right now, that being Sanity. They're not being used, but they are part of the SmackDown brand. I could see them doing a segment maybe to open the show where Evolution comes out and they're talking and they get interrupted by Sanity and they set up a six-man tag match for the main event with Triple H, Randy Orton, and Batista wrestling on that show against Sanity because I think they should wrestle. I think there should be more than just an appearance. If they're going to be there, they should have a match. And Sanity would be an easy win for them. It would be like that DX reunion they did on Raw 1000. This is SmackDown 1000? Well, on Raw 1000, what did they do? They had Damian Sandow out there interacting with DX, and everybody hit him with a finishing move, and everybody cheered. And Sandow was an easy guy who they could put in there and have them beat him up and be made to look like a loser. So they could do a match on SmackDown 1000, and then maybe after the match, Triple H and Randy Orton attack Batista. Maybe they give him the thumbs down like he gave the thumbs down to them all those years ago. Although Randy Orton got his own thumbs down when they kicked him out of the group too. But they could attack him because if you remember, the last time we saw Batista, 4 years ago on Raw, he quit the company and he walked out on Evolution. Triple H was yelling at him as he walked out. He walked out on Evolution. So I would think some payback here would be warranted. Maybe he goes away for a while after that, you know, but comes back and then they build to a match at WrestleMania with him and Triple H. I can't say that it's a match that really excites me, but Triple H has to have his annual obligatory WrestleMania match. And I, of all the WrestleMania dream matches I'm trying to think of for next year, he ain't in any of them. So if Batista wanted to come back and just have his own little match with Triple H, then that's fine. But this, to me, would seem like the simplest way to light that match and get things going. Instead of sad tweet, we have sad Instagram this week. Instagram is where Alberto El Patron, at Pride of Mexico on there, posted a photo with his new lady friend. They were out to dinner with a few people, Sin Cara. Was apparently at that dinner, the WWE one, not the real Sin Cara, who once he beat the piss out of on Raw because he broke his pinky finger and wanted to call off the match. Anyway, he posted a photo at dinner with his girlfriend and these other people, and this is what he said. He said, with friends and family, and then he tagged them, visiting friends in this place with amazing Mexican food, supporting Latin chefs in the California area. Great, nothing wrong with that. Well, somebody posted another, because this is how things devolve. All it takes is one person trying to stir the pot to get things going. And this person posted a comment saying, she's way hotter looking than Paige. And he couldn't resist. Instead of leaving well enough alone and being the bigger person, he did exactly what you would expect him to do. He acted like a piece of trash. And he posted these comments. He said, yes, and this one doesn't have more than 9 police reports against her, or 3 arrests in different states, or committed in 2 mental hospitals like the one you mentioned did. Then he posted another comment. He wasn't done yet. He said, and with real evidence, not just lies from her loser brother. Now, Paige is not innocent as far as when she was in the relationship with Del Rio. I'm sure there was a lot of shit that happened. She's no innocent angel in all this. It was a combustible deal, and they're both better off for being apart from one another. Paige seems to be in a good place now. She's doing very well in the GM role on SmackDown. Del Rio is eating at Mexican restaurants. That's what he's doing. Good for him. If what he says here is true, and he had to put that little dig in there about the mental hospitals, that, if he's being honest, and who the hell knows, that's a pretty fucked up thing to put out there. Because, it's first I'm hearing of that. That's not the sort of thing I would think that she would want people to know about. And things had been very quiet. You know, they had a split a number of months ago. And it's not like they just broke up. This just sort of came out of nowhere because of that one person's comment. And Del Rio decided that he had to be, you know, a piece of shit and go ahead and post these comments for no reason at all. I haven't heard Paige talk about Del Rio whenever she does interviews or people talk to her on social media. She's moved on in her life. Apparently, he's still not over it yet. But to put something out like that, I mean, it's one thing to talk about, you know, oh, this woman, you know, had different police reports against her. Oh, she was committed to two mental hospitals. You know, and then you attack her family and her loser brother. I mean, you know, what kind of fucked up person does that sort of thing? And it's a thing. It was only a few weeks ago he was talking about coming back to WWE for another run before he retires. That's all I hear when this guy does interviews. Are you going to go back to WWE? Of course, I'm going to go back. I'm going to retire there. I'm going to have one last run, and I'm going to work with all these different people. Fuck off. Fuck off. If there's one person that WWE does not need back right now, it is Alberto Del Rio. Believe me, the company will do just fine without him. They don't need him.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
Cassius Ohno is celebrating 20 years in the wrestling business this weekend. He had a match with Adam Cole at the NXT live event in Orlando on Friday night. He beat Cole by DQ in the main event when the Undisputed Era ran into attack. All of a sudden, the lights went out and they played Cesaro's entrance music to a huge pop. He and Ohno cleared the ring together and they celebrated to very loud chants of Kings of Wrestling. You know, when I first started going to Ring of Honor shows 12 years ago, Ohno was still he was still technically a CZW guy, and they were doing the ROH versus CZW interpromotional war deal. So he was the outsider, he was considered to be. And that's when he and Cesaro, this is back in his Claudio days, first got together. He basically, Claudio turned on Ring of Honor and he aligned with Chris Hero, and they formed the Kings of Wrestling. And they and Larry Sweeney together were a great act. And I was there the night they won the ROH tag team titles for their one and only time. They beat Roderick Strong and Austin Aries at Glory by Honor 5 Night 2, which is still one of the best shows I've ever attended live. Maybe the best, honestly. Capped off by Bruno Sammartino getting in the ring and giving this great rousing speech with the entire roster surrounding the ring. It was just this great moment. Anyway, I dug up some old photos I had snapped of the two of them from that night. I put them on my Twitter page if you want to see them. What might have been for Cassius Ohno had CM Punk gotten his way? He would have been the third member of The Shield when they debuted back in 2012. It would have been him, Seth Rollins, and Dean Ambrose, and not Roman Reigns. Now, for the record, I think the WWE made the right choice. I don't think it would have worked as well with Hero being in that role. They needed an enforcer type, and, you know, Cassius Ohno was not that guy. I mean, he's bigger now even than he was then. Then he was still kind of lanky, and it just wouldn't have worked. Roman Reigns, he looked the part, and I think working with Rollins and Ambrose and all those six-man tags for all of 2013 did wonders for the guy. Even if you're not a Roman Reigns fan, if you don't think he's that good, well, he's a hell of a lot better than he would have been had he not worked all those matches, I think, alongside those guys for so long. So it was a smart move on their part, but for Hero, it could have been a life changer. Had he been picked for that role instead of Roman Reigns, it could have changed his entire career. It could have changed his life. As it was, he left NXT, became a sensation again on the indie scene, and then came back to NXT, and he's been a good utility player for them, but he's not really been featured in any sort of prominent role. And in fact, they've incorporated that now into his current storyline with him being very upset. William Regal tends to only use him as sort of a starter in a way, you know, for all the new guys to come in and get in the ring with. It's believable that he would feel that way and be upset about that because it's true. That's exactly how they've been utilizing him. But one day, you know, when Sheamus and Cesaro go the way of the dodo and the bar is no more, I would be down for a Cassius Ohno call-up to reform the Kings of Wrestling. I've all but given up on this idea that they're ever going to push Cesaro as any sort of serious, you know, singles threat. He had the tag team with Jack Swagger. That got over. The team with Sheamus, they've done well together. And he could do it again someday with Ohno. That's assuming that he ever gets called up. And I'm not sure that he will. I wonder, and I don't know what his thoughts are on this. Maybe he's perfectly content to be where he is, but I'm sure if he got the call one day saying, hey, we want you on Raw, I don't know. I tend to think he wouldn't say no to that. But I wonder if they see him as having more value in NXT. You know, maybe as like a player coach type, which I think he sort of is already. And that may just be the role for him going forward. Undisputed Era here this week on NXT opened the show. They interrupted William Regal. Regal was about to announce some progress in his investigation of who attacked Aleister Black. They complained about the War Raiders and Ricochet. Adam Cole wanted his North American Championship rematch. And instead of a one-on-one match on that show, Regal booked a triple threat match for the championship for 2 weeks from now with Pete Dunne and Adam Cole, both challenging Ricochet. So it's going to be a three-way match. That sounds like a hell of a match. Any reason to get Pete Dunne and Ricochet back in the ring is okay with me. And then the week after that, so in 3 weeks, it's going to be Roddy and Kyle O'Reilly defending the NXT Tag Team titles against the War Raiders, undefeated so far in NXT. So all of this seems designed to set things up for a War Games match in November. At least that's how it looks to me. Lars Sullivan destroyed a job guy they called Victor Orchant, even though he oddly had the word Walker written across his ass on his tights. So I had to look this up because I wanted to know what's going on here. So I looked him up, and that is the name that he has used for many, many years on the indie scene. Almost 20 years this guy has been around for. And so they gave him a new name here for the show. But in looking this guy up, you know, it's amazing the things that you either learn when you start, you know, researching and going down that rabbit hole, or things that just jog your memory. I had heard this story. I didn't know the players involved, but I do remember hearing about the story a long time ago. I didn't know that it involved him. So many years ago, this is going back probably 12 or 13 years, like 2005, I think this was. At an indie show, this guy, who on the indie scene, his name is Vordell Walker, which is why his ass had Walker written on it. Vordell Walker was tagging with Dustin Rhodes, the same Dustin Rhodes who thinks your opinion ain't worth a thin dime. Just remember that. He can tweet and delete, but we don't forget. And he teamed up with Walker, and on the opposite side of the ring, it was Rick Steiner and another independent wrestler whose name escapes me. Well, Steiner had a reputation for being a bit of a bully to some people and taking liberties with people, which is not a hard leap to make when you think of those old Steiner Brothers squashes back in the day and how they just fucking brutalized some of those guys. Well, on this night, he had a bee in his bonnet, I guess, and right out of the gate, he was throwing some legit kicks at Vordell Walker. He busted his mouth open. He was kicking the shit out of this guy. Walker, though, instead of just taking it, he gave it right back to him. He threw a bunch of shoot kicks. He took him down. And Steiner was stunned because he probably figured, holy shit, this kid's fighting back. He didn't expect that. Walker stood up to him. He wasn't going to take any of his shit. And it turned into sort of a famous story. Then there was a backstage confrontation, but this guy would not stand down. So when you mention the name Vordell Walker or type it in, you get a lot of those stories about the incident with Rick Steiner, and this guy is probably not somebody that you want to be messing around with. Here, the beating that Lars Sullivan gave him, I'm surprised he didn't come back as a Walker. The Walking Dead is back next Sunday, by the way, for those of you Walking Dead fans out there. The final season with Rick Grimes, and depending on how things play out this season, it could be the last season for me too with that show. EC3 came out. He attacked Sullivan for taking him out a few weeks ago. It'll be Lars Sullivan against EC3 on the show this upcoming Wednesday. You know, even before EC3 got the concussion in the match with Velveteen Dream, which is why he's been out for a few weeks, something was just off for me with EC3. He's just not doing it for me in NXT. Not as a babyface. I think they need to change that. And I'll say this, you know, I had called out Cassius Ohno for being sort of, acting suspiciously and making me think that he is the person who attacked Aleister Black. If it's not Cassius Ohno who attacked Black, then it should be EC3. That would be a good way, I think, to turn him heel, and I think that's the role that he would be better in and more entertaining in. We had the Mighty beating the Street Profits. I don't have a whole lot to say about this. The Mighty is just, I don't know, man. They just don't do it for me. Kairi Sane pinned Vanessa Bourne with the insane elbow. She landed right on top of her with all of her body weight this time. That did not look like it would have been very fun to take. Shayna Baszler came out, confronted Kairi, demanded a rematch for the NXT Women's Championship. And Kairi said that she would get it at the Evolution pay-per-view. So that is your NXT Women's title match on the All Women show. We had Keith Lee backstage accidentally interrupting the finest, Kona Reeves, who was having his hair did backstage. He made a fat joke about Lee being limitless, which is what he calls himself. He's the limitless Keith Lee. Actually, I thought it was pretty funny. But apparently they're going to have a match next week, so get ready for that. Kona Reeves against Keith Lee. Buy your ticket now. Actually, the tickets there are free, so... which is good, because I don't know that I would be buying a ticket to go see Kona Reeves against Keith Lee. Matt Riddle against Keith Lee. Now, that's a match I would buy a ticket for. We had Tommaso Ciampa, the NXT champion in the main event, taking on Otis Dojovic, non-title. I thought Otis looked real good here. This was the first time Otis has been in a singles match like this, the biggest match of his career thus far, and I thought he accounted for himself very well. He acquitted himself very well here in this match. I don't know how many of you saw the stakes video that was up on the WWE YouTube channel about a week ago. Because they always, you know, heavy machinery, they talk about stakes and weights, stakes and weights. Yeah, baby. Come on, Tucker. Yeah, Tucker. Otis is fucking great. So they did a video where they actually followed them around. They bought the meat. They beat the meat. They made the steaks. They're eating the steaks. They're sitting there. They're exhausted. The whole video, it's just funny. You got to go find it. Otis is fantastic, and in this match, he took a sick-looking bump on the two of them, really. One on the metal ramp. Ciampa just grabbed him, threw him backwards, and he landed and smacked the metal ramp. Later on, Ciampa tried to flee, but Tucker Knight came out to block his path, so he couldn't leave. And so Otis gets him in the ring, and he's suplexing him and tossing him around, and Ciampa grabs the referee, who happened to be the female referee in NXT. I think they might have two of them now. This was Jessica, I want to say her name is. He grabs the female referee and uses her as a human shield, which allowed him to hit Otis with an eye rake. What a heel. What a heel this guy is. It's like Macho Man back in the day when people would threaten to dive off the top at him. He would grab Elizabeth. He would grab his wife. He would pull her in harm's way. That's what a heel does. So anyway, we had this brutal draping DDT spot. He DDT'd Otis from the inside of the ring onto the apron. There's this still shot on WWE.com of Otis. His neck, ugh, how he didn't break his neck, I'll never know. And then he gave him a second draping DDT, this time from the apron into the ring. And that was it. Tommaso Ciampa covered him. He got the pin. He pinned Otis. But I thought this was a good showing for him in what has been the biggest singles match thus far, I think, in his short career. Mae Young Classic, week 4. We're finally through the first round, and I am still thoroughly enjoying this tournament. This week, we opened with the best match. Usually it's the final match that's the best match. We had the reverse occur this week. It was Rachel Evers taking on Hiroyo Matsumoto. Evers, of course, is the daughter of Paul Ellering and Cassius Ohno's better half. I believe this is the first time they've ever acknowledged that on WWE television, but they've been dating for a few years now. Matsumoto calls herself Lady Godzilla, and Renee Young said that Matsumoto told her that if she could wrestle any one person, who would it be? She said that it would be The Undertaker. What is with all of these people wanting to wrestle The Undertaker? Don't they realize that he'll never retire if they keep saying these things? Sting still says he wants to wrestle The Undertaker. Now PCO says he wants to wrestle The Undertaker. I was going to say dump Matsumoto. That's a different wrestler. But you got this lady here. She wants to wrestle The Undertaker. I want to wrestle The Undertaker. Why not? Let's just start a line here. We'll all go down the line. We'll all get to wrestle The Undertaker. They should just create The Undertaker Invitational every single year. Men and women are welcome to apply. The Undertaker Invitational, and they can battle for the right to face The Undertaker at WrestleMania. So Matsumoto won with a Saito suplex and a deadlift. That's coming off a deadlift powerbomb. She got the pin. That surprised me. I thought Rachel Evers was going to move on in this tournament. I thought it would be Evers against Toni Storm. Instead, it will be Matsumoto against Toni Storm, which should be a hell of a... I think that'll be a hell of a battle. We have Jesse Eleban against Tainara Kanchi. That's how they pronounced it. Don't yell at me. Kanchi was in last year's Mae Young Classic. She was also in the WrestleMania Women's Battle Royal. Eleban reminds me of a mix between Bayley and Dakota Kai. She's like somewhere in there. She's very young. Her gimmick is that of somebody who, I guess, is clumsy and falls down a lot and just bounces around like a rubber ball. And I think she would probably do very well in NXT if they sign her and they put her on NXT television. But once she hits the main roster, it's all over. She's dead. This was no good. She won't be hitting NXT television, I don't think, anytime soon. This was no good. This was, and I'm not even putting it all on Jesse. This was not good at all. Kanchi won with a spinning side slam. She immediately began crying. I don't know if she was crying because the match was so bad, or if she just felt overwhelmed with emotion that she won. I'd like to think it was the first one so that she can get better. Nicole Matthews took on Isla Dawn. I didn't think this was much better than the match before it, sadly. It was a little bit better. I know Nicole Matthews has wrestled a lot of different places, but this just seemed very average to me. Isla Dawn is part of the NXT UK Women's Division. She was trained by Killian Dane. Remember him? Before WWE Killian'd his career? She also calls herself the Modern Day Witch. And Renee Young said that she was hoping she would use some witchcraft here in this match. I would like for her to put a hex on the people writing Monday Night Raw. Can they do that? Can Isla Dawn do that? Can she put some sort of curse on the people that write that television show? Because I would like to see that. My voodoo doll, apparently, from many years ago that I mentioned, did not do the trick. Remember when I threatened to use a voodoo doll if we got one more John Cena-Randy Orton match? Maybe I should bust out the voodoo doll and start using it on those Raw writers. Maybe I need to do that. So sadly, we didn't get to see any witchcraft here in this match. Although, I will say, I do think a Mama Shango gimmick could work. Even today, even in 2018, almost 2019, I think Mama Shango could work. So Matthews won with a lion tamer. Knee on the back of the head, the whole nine yards. Chris Jericho would be proud of her form here on this move. Unfortunately for her, though, it's going to be a while before we see her in a WWE ring ever again, unless she joins the NXT UK Women's Division, even though she's Canadian. Maybe there's some sort of border policy for the division where they'll allow people in even if they're not from the UK. But there was a note in this week's Wrestling Observer that Nicole Matthews had issues recently coming across the US border. And the same thing that happened to Speedball Mike Bailey has now happened to Nicole Matthews. She is banned from entering the United States for a period of 5 years. What a stupid rule. That just is so ridiculous. So she can't work here now. I was only half joking. I think that if WWE wants her, if they want to use her, then why not offer her a spot in the NXT UK Women's Division? She could turn it down if she doesn't want to work there or move there, but it'd be a shame if, you know, she lost out on some opportunity to be part of WWE if they wanted her because of this stupid bullshit at the border. Hopefully they can bring her in other ways and do something with her maybe over there. And then it was the debut of perhaps some would say, the greatest women's wrestler right now on the planet, maybe one of the best of all time, when all is said and done. She's still pretty young. Hard to believe that she's got all of these accolades, and I think she's only, what is she, 29? 20, 27? She's still very young. Io Shirai, in a WWE ring here for the very first time, against Xia Brookside, the 19-year-old daughter of UK legend and WWE trainer Robbie Brookside, who was ringside watching his daughter wrestle live for the very first time. And, of course, she didn't stand a chance in there against Io Shirai. She got a few moves in. I think she looked fine. I mean, she's still very young. She's still very inexperienced. But she could obviously have a future. She's got a good look. She's been doing this now for about 3 years. And I believe I want to say she is already signed to be part of the NXT UK women's division. I believe she is. But I mean, here, come on. This was never in doubt. Io won with a moonsault off the top, landed knees first right on top of Xia. Xia is not a big girl. She's a very tiny petite girl. And so I'm surprised that when Io landed on her, it's like squeezing a ketchup bottle. I'm surprised that we didn't see like guts and shit just sort of explode out of her eye sockets and her ears. She landed with her knees full force right on top of her and got the pin. And so this was a quick win to establish Io Shirai with an audience I suspect already knows how good she is, and those who don't, they got a taste of that here. And so now we move on to the second round. Presumably, we will have longer matches now with longer time limits, and I think it's only going to get better from here. I mean, there were a lot of very short, average matches in this first round. There were also about three really, really good ones, but this was more meant to familiarize people, I think, with the different personalities. Now we're going to get into, I think, the real special part of this tournament. I've enjoyed it so far, and I think it's going to get even better. So I can't wait for this week's episode. It's kind of weird to be watching something produced by WWE lately that genuinely has me excited to tune in the following week. I guess NXT is kind of like that, but even NXT, you know, it's hit or miss. Some weeks are better than others. But I have thoroughly enjoyed this tournament so far. Lucha Underground. I spoke too soon last week when I said that it had been a while since we had a good death on this show. This week we lost Jack Evans. First he came out and he quit. He said, I can't work for a place that allows Exolicious to wrestle. And Antonio Cueto came out and said, well, if you win this next match, then you can leave. But if you lose, you will be sacrificed to the gods. And out came Matanza. They had a brief match. Matanza won with the Wrath of the Gods, and Jack was sacrificed. I've lost count of how many people we've lost this season. I had done a tally a few weeks ago. I don't remember what the number was, 7, 8, 9, something like that. This might be death number 10 for the year. The Reptile Tribe retained its Trios Tag Team titles over the team of Ivelisse, Joey Ryan, and Exolicious. Two different lollipops Joey Ryan pulled out during the course of this match from his crotch region, ended up in Sammy Callahan's mouth. He may have gonorrhea in his throat now. He should get that checked immediately. Daga submitted Joey Ryan with an armbar for the win. Paul London showed up introducing the White Rabbit, Killer Cross, to the audience for the very first time. He was all dressed up in his suit with his, I think he was wearing a bow tie. He had him. He had El Bunny with him, which at one point during the match, I believe Vampiro asked Matt Stryker, do you know what El Bunny means? And Matt Stryker said, the bunny. He was correct. That is exactly what it means. Even I knew that. I'm pretty sure El Bunny is the same guy who played Masquerita Sagrada. I'm not 100% sure about that. Maybe if our pal Famous B hears this, he can chime in and let me know. But London and the Bunny beat up Ivelisse, Ryan, and Exolicious while Killer Cross looked on and kept saying, tick-tock, tick-tock. Jake Strong had what I thought was his best match thus far in Lucha Underground, which he should have, given that he was wrestling Drago and Aerostar. Aerostar is quite good. This was a nunchucks match. Michelangelo of the Ninja Turtles would be very proud. Now we just need to get a pizza on a pole match. Matt Stryker said they were able to have this match sanctioned by the State Athletic Commission in California because Drago and Aerostar are professional practitioners of nunchucks. Which is an odd thing to say given that this is supposed to be an underground show about fighting. Illegal fighting. But I just love the idea that, you know, they might not sanction a match that has nunchucks in it, but the commission apparently thinks that sacrificing people is okay. We already know the California State Athletic Commission is suspect at best. Drago spit mist in Jake Strong's face, and he hit him with the nunchuck. Strong, in retaliation, then tossed him 5 rows deep into a bunch of empty rows of chairs in the crowd. He went to go powerbomb Aerostar, but Aerostar reached up, and he grabbed hold of a ladder that took him up to the balcony. And he was going up there. There was a second set of nunchucks up there that he retrieved. Jake climbed the ladder, followed him up there onto the balcony, and he dropped him. So basically, he ended up dropping Aerostar off the balcony. He was dangling off the side. He dropped him. And he fell, and we lost sight of him. He could have fallen into a black hole for all we know. He just fell into the crowd, and we don't know where he went. So he was gone for a while. But later on, Aerostar returned. He did a dive off the balcony. Somehow he got back up there. He did a dive off the balcony down onto Strong. It was all for naught because in the end, Strong submitted Aerostar with the ankle lock. And then after the match, he snapped Drago's ankle. They had to add in that cheesy sound effect for it too, which I hate. But this was the best Strong match to date. I know that isn't saying much. I have not been impressed by him in Lucha Underground. I still don't think he really belongs there. But this was good for what it was. In the main event, we have Pentagon Dark defeating Mil Muertes, King Cuerno, and Dragon Azteca Jr. to earn a rematch with Marty the Moth Martinez for the Lucha Underground Championship at Ultima Lucha 4, which is coming up, I think, in the next couple of weeks. This is a shorter season than we usually get. I think it's only about 22 episodes. Phoenix came out during the match. He did his little zombie walk out. He grabbed Melissa Santos. And Melissa's looking at him and just saying, trying to talk some sense into him. What are you doing? Calm down. And she found a moment where she could escape. So she just broke free and she ran for her life. And as she went to go run away, Dragon Azteca did a cannonball dive, a running cannonball dive out over the ring post. He landed on top of Phoenix. Both guys, they crashed into the side of the announce desk. Later on, the Mac came out. He hit 2 stunners on Mil Muertes, which allowed Pentagon to hit a Mexican destroyer on Muertes for the win. So Pentagon will get to challenge Marty the Moth again at Ultima Lucha for the championship. Meanwhile, Mac grabbed the mic and challenged Mil Muertes. So Mac grabbed the mic to talk to Mil about a death match. He challenged him to a literal death match at Ultima Lucha. Not one of these like, oh, we'll call it a death match and you'll be back on TV the very next night. On this show, I take this as a literal death threat. And the usually very mild-mannered Mac capped it off by saying, rest in peace, motherfucker. Now, he didn't say it as white as I just did. He said it a lot cooler. He sounded a lot more badass than I just did. But I think a well-placed, unexpected F-bomb is always a good way to end a show. It's one advantage that Lucha Underground has over pretty much every other wrestling show out there. Even in New Japan, they're trying to sanitize things and tell Tama Tonga not to curse anymore. So I thought that was a fun way to end. Overall, you know, average show. They're building, obviously, to Ultima Lucha. And we'll see what happens at Ultima Lucha. And then I don't know if they have another half or what would be season 5 already in the can. I have to check. I don't know if they're already sort of prepared to air, you know, the next season. How long the break might be between seasons, I'm not sure. Because we had quite the break previously before season 4 came back, so we could be down to our last few Lucha Underground episodes for a long time here. Let's do a quick mailbag here. If you have questions, you can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Lee from Spartanburg, South Carolina. As I've heard you mention multiple times, when the stars of NXT make it to the main roster, they usually fizzle out, because the main roster has no idea what to do with them. For all of the NXT stars that have fizzled out, I wanted to know who you thought has been the best male and female superstar to be called up from NXT in 2018. There have not been that many female call-ups this year. I went back through the list, and I was looking. I wanted to see how many women went to Raw, how many women went to SmackDown, and there really haven't been very many. I would say Ember Moon by default. And even she really hasn't done all that much. I wanted to say Ruby Riott, but the Riott Squad got called up at the end of last year. I thought it was this year, but it was the end of last year. But this year it's been Ember. It's been the Iconics, who haven't done shit on SmackDown. They've done nothing. And Zelina Vega. And I think Zelina Vega is great, but she's barely wrestled. And, you know, as a manager, she really hasn't made that much of a dent yet. I think as, hopefully, as Cien Almas climbs the ladder on that show a little bit more, she'll be featured more prominently. And she'll be able to have kind of a breakout year for herself in 2019. But I would probably just go with Ember by default. As far as the men, it's got to be, I mean, this was an easy one for me. It's got to be Drew McIntyre. He's been right in the thick of things on Raw for the last few months with Dolph Ziggler. He's challenging Seth Rollins, Dean Ambrose, and now Roman Reigns. They're headlining the show on some weeks like they did recently. I mean, now they're the tag team champions, but there was that match, I think it was 2 weeks ago, maybe they were headlining Raw. Even on Raw this past Monday, they weren't wrestling, but they were out there, you know, during the main event. They are part of the main running storyline on that show. And Drew is as much a part of that as Braun or Dolph. And to me, you know, McIntyre hasn't even tapped into his full potential yet insofar as how far he can go on that show. Now, AOP had their first taste of the Raw main event this week. They didn't win, but they didn't get pinned either. They were protected. So, you know, they'd be on the list as well, I guess. Andrade Cien Almas is a star in the making. You don't need me to tell you that. You watch this guy out there, it's obvious that he is a star in the making on that show. And it's going to take a special kind of stupid to screw him up. I would not put it past them. It is possible. They have proven me wrong before. They have some very, you know, great magical powers to make that happen. But I think it's going to take a lot to derail him. So I see big things in his future, but I have to go Drew McIntyre. He has been the most successful, I think, call-up of any kind, male or female, for the year from NXT to the main roster. Sanity, you know, I mentioned them a little while ago. Sanity is sort of the polar opposite. I never saw, now me personally, I never saw them as anything really special, even when they were in NXT. But they surely could be doing more than they are right now, and they never really had a chance. Really, from the very first week they debuted, you know, they lost, I think. It was either that first week or second week, and they really haven't recovered. There's been no reason for people to get behind them either as a threat or get behind them and take them seriously at all. McIntyre, thankfully, they have not done that with. They've protected him as well they should because he could be a future Universal Champion. Greg writes in, what's happening with the Colt Cabana CM Punk lawsuit? I have not heard anything since the news broke on August 9th. It is nearing 2 months and not a word from Punk's legal team. Do you have any insight? In Illinois and in most lawsuit cases, the defendant has 30 days to proceed or respond rather to the suit. That is a good question, Greg. I don't have an answer for you. I tried to get one before I started recording here. I couldn't find anything. It is possible that Punk's attorneys requested additional time to respond, which I think that would be a standard thing that would be allowed. But beyond that, I have not been able to find anything new. There's been nothing new reported. So right now, I just don't know. Andrew from Minnesota, I had a dreadful realization. WWE is going to have Charlotte win the women's title back from Becky Lynch at Starrcade, just so they can have the visual of Charlotte winning the championship in a cage at Starrcade exactly 35 years to the day that Ric Flair did the exact same thing. Please tell me I am wrong. I can't do that, Andrew. I'm sorry, brother. I can't do that. It could happen. November 24th, Cincinnati, Ohio. They're doing another Starrcade house show. And again, I don't believe this is airing on the network because I know people are going to ask about that. I don't believe it is scheduled to air on TV. Now, that doesn't mean they, you know, wouldn't do a title change there, even if it doesn't air on TV. They very well could. I just feel like there'd be a better chance of it if it were back in Greensboro, like it was last year. Starrcade in Greensboro, right around Thanksgiving, like that was kind of a cool nostalgia gimmick. So now they're bringing it back again, and they're doing it in Cincinnati. And I'm not sure why Cincinnati, other than it's just the building that was available that day, and so they booked it. But could it happen? Yes, it could happen. They have two matches before then. They have a match Saturday in Australia. They have probably another one at Evolution. I don't see Charlotte losing all of those matches. So take your pick as far as which one it'll be. My guess is that it happens at Evolution. Abbas from Iraq. We always hear about Stone Cold and The Rock as the two biggest names that represent the Attitude Era, but I think it's unfair for people like The Undertaker, Mankind, Triple H, Sable, Chris Jericho, Mr. McMahon, and Kane, who are not mentioned enough. How would you rank the five biggest names of the Attitude Era? How would I rank them? Stone Cold number one, The Rock number two, Mr. McMahon number three, The Undertaker number four, and Kane number five. That would be my ranked top five biggest names of the Attitude Era. Just obviously focusing on WWE. Stone Cold, The Rock, Vince McMahon, The Undertaker, and Kane. And then after that, if you want to expand that out to the top seven, it would be Mankind, and then rounding out the pack, pulling up the rear, would be Triple H. But that would be my order of importance. Yours, obviously, may be different. Orlando from Philadelphia. I always love saying that. Orlando from Philadelphia. That's like New York from Dallas. Buy or sell on the better CM Punk match from 2013, Punk versus The Undertaker at WrestleMania 29, or CM Punk versus Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. That is a great buy or sell. Both of those matches are two of the best matches of CM Punk's career. Those are two of the very best matches that he has had ever in all the time he spent in WWE, and they both happened to come in the same year within a few months of each other. Me personally, I cannot vote against the Brock Lesnar match. I am buying on the SummerSlam match. I am selling on the WrestleMania match. I like the SummerSlam match more, even though the WrestleMania one was a hell of a lot better, I think, than I expected it to be going in. And so you can't go wrong with either one of those matches, but to me, the better match and the match of the year. I think when I did the whole year-end sound-off awards stuff, I'm pretty sure I gave match of the year honors to that SummerSlam match between Lesnar and Punk. It was just such a great match. You know, now there was the size difference, but I think that played into the story. Punk was the underdog going in. He pulled a match out of Brock Lesnar that was as good as any Brock Lesnar match he has had since he came back to the company in 2012. Maybe the best. I'd have to go back and sort of look at them all, but it was fantastic. It was just a great, great match. That and the John Cena-Daniel Bryan match that headlined the show that night. It was kind of a 1-2 punch of great matches that evening. And the Punk and Lesnar bet, I could go back and watch that match anytime. I can't do that with just any match. It is hard for me to go back and watch recent matches again, just at random. But that's one of those matches that I could always go back and watch. It's just that good. Keith from Covington, Kentucky. We'll end with this, a non-wrestling question. With the new Halloween movie coming out next month, and you've been doing rankings lately, how would you rank the Halloween movies? So that's a tough one, but not really. I guess it's tough in that it actually gets tougher for me to rank the shitty ones. Like the ones up front, the best ones for me, that's easy. Once I was getting into the later ones, that's where I had some trouble when I wrote this down for you. But for me, the best is and will always be the original. It just can't be topped. It's like the 92 Rumble. It just cannot be topped. I mean, sometimes the stars just align, like it did for that match, in terms of the star power you've got in there, and just things fall into place. And the original movie is just so great in the sense of, just the sense of dread, but it doesn't rely on gore. It doesn't rely on blood. There's basically no blood at all, really, in the movie. No gore. It's not like just slasher kills, and let's see, you know, how many creative ways we can come up with to slice and dice up this body here. And I'm not even saying that that's a bad thing. I mean, there's a lot of slasher films I enjoy. The first Scream, I still think, is a great movie. But that first Halloween movie is, between the score and the way it was filmed, and just the simplicity of it all, you know, and no big special effects. It was an independently made film. It's great. It stands the test of time, even though it was made in 1978. And so here that's right, 1978. So this is 40 years. This is the 40th anniversary, I guess, right? 10, 20, 34, 40-year anniversary of the first Halloween. Wow. That's crazy. That's crazy. And here we have John Carpenter back with Jamie Lee Curtis. And here we go again. Brand new Halloween movie coming out October 19th. I can't wait. So the first one is number one. The second one, let's backtrack a little bit here. I'm going to go from top to the bottom, okay? Number one is the original, first Halloween movie. Number two on my list would be Halloween 3. And I know that's going to piss a lot of people off. There's a lot of hate for that movie. As I've said before, I also was on the hate bandwagon for that movie. It had nothing to do with Michael Myers, so why is it called Halloween? It gets a bad rap because of the title. If they called it anything else, I think that movie would have an even bigger following than it does now. It is a good horror movie. It really is. And it should be judged on its own merits. If you've never seen it, I would give it a shot. I didn't see it for many, many years later. I finally watched it and I loved it. So much so that I would put it at number two on my list. Number three would be Halloween 2. Number four would be Halloween 4, which got back to the Michael Myers character and storyline, and Dr. Loomis was back, even though it was ridiculous given how it ended in Halloween 2, that he would even be alive, but there he was. But it was cool to see him back and to get the Michael Myers character back. But shout out to Danielle Harris, who was, I don't know how old she was at the filming of the movie. She may have only been 8 years old. She was very, very young, and it was maybe her first real acting role, and I thought she did a tremendous job. In part four and part five, she was in both. But part four is also, I think, very underrated. It's not as good as the original, but it is, I think it's a very good horror movie with a good performance from a very young actress. And the end of that movie, which I won't spoil, I won't give it away, but the end of that movie, boy, they could have gone in some real cool directions with that. They never did. They sort of dropped the ball, I think, on that. It was a very cool way for the movie to end, again, without giving it away. Because there might be some people who never saw these before who say, hey, okay, I'll take your word for it. I'll go watch it. Go watch it. It's not a bad movie. Now, they do progressively get worse. I'd put number five in the number five spot, but five was not as good as four. Really, after that, five I could tolerate, even though it's not really a great movie. Once you get past that, that's where things just, to me anyway, they go downhill. I'm not really a big fan of any of the movies that came after that. If I had to choose what goes at number six on the list, it sure as hell isn't Halloween 6, which was The Curse of Michael Myers. That movie is hot garbage. I would say in the number six spot, I would go H2O, Halloween H2O, the 20th anniversary edition. It came out in 1998. Jamie Lee Curtis was back for that one. It had, you know, LL Cool J was in there. I guess after H2O, I guess the Rob Zombie films after that. Well, I'd put Rob Zombie the first one, and then after that I would put the second Rob Zombie one, even though I didn't really like those either. Halloween 6, though, that one I mentioned, the one with Paul Rudd, The Curse of Michael Myers, I can't stress enough, I just did not like that movie. I just thought that movie was dog shit. And then rounding out the list on the very bottom would be Halloween Resurrection with Busta Rhymes. If Halloween 6 was dog shit, then Halloween Resurrection was cat piss. See, I tolerated LL Cool J in one Halloween film. He wasn't offensive to me. He was fine. I tolerated that. Busta Rhymes was a bridge too far for me. And that's when they start getting cute by putting celebrities in these movies, and I don't like that. And plus, it just wasn't a very good movie. So I put Resurrection on the very bottom of the list. But it doesn't really matter. I mean, once you get past part four and five, to me, it's all, you may as well just jumble them all together in one big ball of shit and just leave it sitting there, because it doesn't matter what the order is. They're just not good. All you would need to watch, focus on the first one, give the third one a chance, and give the fourth one a chance too. Because like the third one, I feel like it also gets a bad rap, and it shouldn't. It really shouldn't, because it's not that bad of a film. But yeah, October 19th is the new Halloween reboot. This one ignores every Halloween movie that came after the original in 1978, including the second one. And if you remember, it was in the second movie that they added that little storyline twist where it's revealed that Michael's sister is Laurie Strode, the character played by Jamie Lee Curtis. That was not in the original film. They did not want that to be in the film. The first film did so well that they had to do a second one, and this is the storyline that they came up with. If it were their choice, there would have been one Halloween movie with Michael Myers, and it would have been a series of Halloween films, each one its own independent story, hence Halloween 3. Unfortunately, that one crapped the bed, and they felt pressured to go back to Michael Myers, which is where Part 4 came into play. But if you read up on the history of the whole franchise, it was John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. It was the two of them, really, who sort of, they were the brainchild of the Halloween series, and that was their plan. They wanted to have a series of films with the Halloween title, and maybe a different subtitle for each, maybe. But they were completely separate, different stories. So think Black Mirror. Those of you who watch the show Black Mirror on Netflix, I don't believe any of the episodes are connected, but they're all part of the Black Mirror series, even though they have nothing to do with each other. That was the original idea for the Halloween series. And then along came Part 3, and, well, we all know what happened there. So October 19th, though, I'll be there. I'll be one of the first in theaters to go see it. Should be good. I got my hopes up for it. If you have questions for the mailbag, you could email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com, please. Keep sending in your questions. My plan for the show next week, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, is I'm not planning on doing a proper show, like sticking to the usual format. I am going to review Super Showdown on Saturday, a few hours after it ends. I will get that review up on YouTube. You can find it there. It will be exclusive to YouTube probably until Sunday, because I'll put the audio up in episode 567. And then after that, we'll do a giant mailbag. And I'll take as many questions from you guys as I can. And that's it. That's all I'm planning on doing for episode 567 next week. Obviously, if there's a big story, big breaking news, I'll cover it. I just can't. This is the week from hell. And I don't want to spend my entire birthday weekend just doing nothing but, you know, taking down notes and preparing to, you know, watch 5 gazillion shows. And I'm not doing it. So that's the plan for next weekend. There'll still be a show. There'll still be plenty of audio for you guys. Don't forget, we have a brand new shirt in our store in celebration of Halloween. The Halloween-themed or Halloween-inspired shirt, I guess you would say. I like it. I think it's pretty badass. You can pick it up there, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. You can get it in charcoal. You can get it in blood red. Got two different color options for you. Ships all over the world, up to a size 5XL. Pick up a shirt and support the show. I will see you guys, maybe some of you at Comic-Con on Thursday here in New York. I'll see you guys for Super Showdown next weekend on the YouTube channel and episode 567. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the first week of October, and I will see you guys next weekend. Until then, take care.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off. What?
This Impact show has moved so many times. It's got more fucking moves than Bruno Mars, this show does. Don't believe me, just watch. Impact started out on Friday, then moved to Saturday, Thursday, then they moved it to Monday. They got slaughtered, so they moved it back to Thursday, then they moved it to Wednesday, Friday again, then back to Wednesday, Tuesday, and now back to Thursday. It's like the Big Show of TV shows. It's turned 1,000 times already, and the only time people pay any attention to it is when it makes them laugh.
Solomonster Sounds Off. Since 2007, The Solomonster Sounds Off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster Sound Off.